Hello, everybody. I'm Kim. I'm in secular recovery. Jeffrey, thank you for the share and thank you for the book. Sincerely, thank you for the book. I, as almost everybody in this room right now knows, have never been to a traditional AA meeting, and I don't own the Big Book. I'm a year, well, now a little more than a year into this thing, and I do have a question for you. Near the end of your book, you say, "Online communities are okay, but I'd advise against settling for one instead of a real world community. Interacting online tends to be much less personal." And I'm not exactly sure when you wrote the book. Actually, there's somebody in this room. I know she's smiling now because I've cured her of that phrase, "in the real world." This is my real world. I have never been to anything but secular, never been to anything but a Zoom meeting. And I have to tell you, I love these people. This connection has been right up there with the most important, if not the most important, factors in my recovery. And it brings me joy to come to these meetings. Ireland is my home, even though I'm in Eugene, Oregon. And also I find these same people in, at Stonehenge and in Toronto. So I'm saving up for real life hugs when I see most of these people, but I tell you what, you get me in a room with strangers. If they reach out and grab my hand, I'm probably going to punch them in the head or something. I don't want to do a live meeting. So I'm wondering if your thoughts have changed at all on that.
Thanks for the question. It's funny because when I was like, oh crap, did I write that? when you said it just now, like, and I remember my thinking behind writing that is my concern is it's very being in a person of avoidance myself. When the two are equally available, which obviously has changed drastically, when the two are equally available, I think it's possible, and it could be easy for some people to stick with what's easiest. I do think there is value to meeting people face to face, but absolutely, I would never say, like, if you're exclusively online, you're not experiencing a real recovery community. So I think it's helpful to have that component. I know it was a big part of my recovery, but also, that was my situation. I don't know. Is it possible that if I only had online meetings and stuff like that, that I would have been even more connected to more people because there were more people available? Maybe. I don't know. So yeah, I certainly wouldn't say. I'm going to probably alter that for the second edition. but yeah, that was definitely written pre-COVID. It was written more when, like, you know, there were meetings all over the place. And also, I spent a lot of my recovery, like, in the San Fernando Valley in Los Angeles, where there's tons of in-person meetings. And it would almost be more challenging to find an online meeting because there's real life. Face to face, I'll say, flesh, real life, face to face meetings everywhere. So yeah, I really, really appreciate you bringing that up, and that is something that my thoughts have changed on a bit. And I think, you know, I think there can be tremendously helpful communities and connections built online, and in a lot of ways, it's more convenient, more accessible. People are more comfortable. You're in your own house. You can turn off the camera if you need to, you know, like, go use the restroom. You don't have to worry about, like, getting up when the meeting's quiet and moving chairs around and interrupting the meeting. It's just a different experience. And so I think it absolutely could be a great choice for people. So yeah, I appreciate you bringing that up.
Hi, everybody. I'm Andrea, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you very much, Jeffrey, for sharing and for your really wonderful book. We were talking about it the other day. I love your section on step four. It is so much clearer than the Big Book. It's so much more ideologically. I have more ideological affection for it. than I did for the Judeo-Christian version. I have a more affinity for the Buddhist perspective, but it is a perspective. So, for example, I love the fact that you included sentience. Like, there's nowhere in the Big Book or any of the AA literature that says that we should do a harms inventory for sentient beings. You actually use the word, right, Jeffrey? Did that come easily for you, deciding to actually put that question in there about harms we may have done to sentient beings? And moreover, that's one quick question. And you don't mention anything about maybe like my inventory regarding, say, the climate, because there's no sentient being presumably with the climate itself, but it seems to be dying. So it might be nice there. And finally, I think you also mentioned, I was looking, but I wanted to hear you share. I think you mentioned something about that we should, your suggestion to do a harms inventory around historically oppressed groups. Like, you know, where am I racist? Where am I homophobic? Where have I discriminated based on ethnicity, gender, things like that? But remind me, did you in fact include those categories in your harms list? So thanks again for writing a great book, and I really recommend it to newcomers. It's wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you for that. That's a great question, and that's a really good, I mean, so I try to keep it as general as possible, because we're looking, my hope is that we're looking at all the harms that we've done. And so I like the idea of listing those sort of as examples. And I certainly, I know when I was doing my own harms list, I had considered, you know, ways that I judged people, mistreated people based on, you know, any identifying characteristic. But I do like the idea of making that more of a really conscious, and especially the environment too, even though the environment itself is not sentient, it's every sentient being relies on it. So harming the environment, therefore, you know, causes harm to sentient beings. So yeah, I like the idea of adding more specificity. I feel like there's always, I feel like I now have to revisit mine a little bit, because I don't think I had ever really come at it from those specific angles. And yeah, I think that's
actually, I think you do, like, not to correct you about your own book, but I think you actually do say something in here. I'm sorry I didn't underline it, but I think you do say something about, have I judged people on the color of their skin or been prejudiced or something like that. There's a few, or okay, women or something. I do think you touch on it. And I know for sure you have the line in there about sentience. So you, yeah, do it for you, Jeffrey.
I mean, yeah, I want to include any type of potential harm that we can do to people. And so I wanted to keep it general, but also put a couple guideposts in there. And yeah, that's definitely, I like that. I'm writing that down, and I want to be more explicit about that in future editions. So thank you. That was great. I don't know if I answered your question there. I just really, honestly, I just really appreciate that take on it.
Hey, I'm Jonah. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Jeffrey. It was really great to hear your story. You know, you said you don't think you're special, and don't, you know, think your experience or you know, perspective is any more valuable than anyone else's. So I just want to assure you that I don't think you're special. I don't put you on a pedestal. And I may be the only person here who actually hasn't read your book, although it's been recommended to me many times. And I've actually recommended it sight unseen to people, to newcomers who are, you know, struggling and want to do some secular step work. I just wanted to say, you know, in the vein of, you know, sharing in response to a qualification or a lead share, that I really identified with a lot of your story, you know, that the boredom, the end just being like self-loathing and boredom and disgust with the way I was behaving. I was also a solitary drunk and a pot smoker and, you know, sitting at home, getting high and getting drunk and passing out and rinse and repeat. I mean, my bottom was also internal. And, you know, I like that you talked about that because, you know, I feel like there's kind of a stereotype or sort of an assumption in, you know, in the program that like you have to hit rock bottom. And I really hate the concept of rock bottom because like, why are we telling people they have to destroy their lives before they can get sober? You know, it just kind of baffles me. So like, I was like, no, I could, like, I knew it could have gotten worse and I knew what worse looked like because I'd seen it in my family. You know, I'd seen it in my mother. So I wasn't, you know, I was able to kind of build the floor under myself at that point. Things were pretty bad, but you know, I wasn't in jail, I wasn't in the hospital. But I like the way you talked about avoidance. That's been a big part of my sort of, you know, addictive kind of, you know, personality disorder. You know, there's a lot of avoidant behavior that I, you know, that I learned from, you know, my alcoholic parent. And, you know, it's a big part of what I struggle with in therapy and in, you know, the work that I do in my sobriety. I just, you know, just wanted to thank you for sharing and, you know, it's good to be here. It's good to see you all. I actually have to run to another thing, but, it was great to, you know, see your face and I love you all.
I know that phrase too. I've used it myself. What other people think of us is none of our business. But I still find myself like a little kid, like, well, why? Why isn't any of our business? Why should I just ignore it? You know, doesn't it mean something? Isn't there some aspect of reality that's being reflected back in these people? And so I think what was more helpful for me was to really just realize and think about how much people's own perceptions and experiences and biases play into the way they perceive you. And just how little it has to do with any objective measure of you and how much of it has to do with their own experience and the people that they've been raised by and the people they've had in their life and their values. And so, you know, I if you've ever read The Four Agreements, it's a really good book, but he talks in there about not taking anything personally. And I like that kind of approach. And he goes into it by talking about just how, you know, other people's perception of you is just built entirely on their own experiences and worldview and perceptions and everything, and really none of it is objectively you, and you're also a different person to different people and in different situations and depending on your mood and so what one person thinks about you at one point is not by any means a reflection of who you are all the time. Or yeah, and it depends on their mood. Depends on their mood when you do the thing that they judge you. I mean, it's so fickle, right? So somebody's perception of you and idea of you is so fickle. And so that was helpful to me. Having said that, I think there's a place, like if somebody has an experience of me, I think it's important for me to hear them out and to say, oh, when I said this, you took it this way, or you heard this. Okay, I will take that into consideration. So I think it's important to listen to people and to take feedback, but to also not take it as like this gospel that this is indicative of something factual about me. This is something I have to take as truth about who I am. So I hope that makes some sense. But it's a nuanced thing, like everything, right? Like, it's not, we just don't care what anyone thinks about us ever. That's the kind of black and white thinking that I can fall into easily, sort of with my addict type thinking. Right? It's all or nothing. It's 100% or 0%. And the truth is, it's like, it's very, very nuanced. So just to briefly touch on that. The finding my own voice, huge. I never knew how to speak up for myself at all. Like when I was a kid, they wanted to hold me back in like kindergarten because I never talked, extremely shy, never knew how to like state a preference. I would rather do this. It was all what everyone else wanted to do. I was just so timid. And so that's been a big part for me, is finding a voice and being able to speak assertively. I feel like assertive communication is one of the key things, but I also realize that I'm lucky being a white male. When I'm assertive, it's like, oh, look at this assertive. Hey, he's confident. Whereas, you know, I have a lot of respect for women and minorities and other people who, you know, when they're assertive, it's seen as more of a negative thing. So I realize how difficult it is for different people. And I think it's still so, so important. But yeah, thank you for bringing that up.
All right, I'll go ahead. Yeah, my name is Jeb, and I'm a very grateful recovered alcoholic addict. And it's good to meet you virtually, Jeffrey. I certainly hear an awful lot, read a lot of your book at various means. It's gotten very popular, and congratulations there that you've written a book that people are finding helpful. One of the things that, I love the fact that you referred to relationships and also self-reflection, especially. For me, the self-reflection thing is the continuing use of the process outlined on step four. And I don't mean simply looking at resentments, fears, and sex relations. For me, the most important part of the fourth step is a sane and sound ideal for all of my future relationships, not just the romantic and sexual. Because when I first was introduced to the fourth step, I recognized that I treated everybody the same way. And the root of my problem was my selfishness, self-centeredness, and it was all about me, which was a sign of my immaturity, my infantile self-centeredness, egocentricity. I take seriously a lot of the things that I read and that I've heard. The most important for me, perhaps, is what Bill wrote in the 12th step. Though he, you know, when he wrote about working with others, but he didn't really talk about practicing these principles, these steps in all of our affairs. But he corrected that in the 12 and 12, where he said at the 12th step, we begin to practice these all 12 steps on a daily basis so that we and those around us can find emotional sobriety. So that's why it's so important for me to have that picture of the kind of person I want to be. I'm reminded of a song in a movie I think it was probably in the 40s. I never saw the movie, but it says, accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, and don't mess with mystery in between. And I think that's the sort of thing where the four-step process, where I outline and continue to outline my most glaring and my common human weaknesses and defenses, is very important. But then also in the fourth step, my strengths that have been there all the time, that would show themselves, and I try to build on that today. And that became to be a part of the kind of person that I want to look at in the mirror at the end of the day and say, how'd you do? And, I fortunately, when I was working on my first four step, I had a visit from a friend who became a Buddhist monk, and he suggested to me that every morning I take a timer into the kitchen, to the bathroom or the bedroom in front of a mirror, and look myself in the eye and say, James Earl Barrett, who are you? James Earl Barrett, who are you? And that was basically what he said. You know, your fourth step is to find who you are. What is your will in your life, as is suggested in the book? And, even at this point in sobriety, I still do that. And I'm finding that I'm much more the kind of person that I'm happy with, that I am at peace with, that I can love and accept unconditionally than I could 40 years ago. And I just, one of the pieces about relationships in the 12 and 12, I think is so key to what I'm talking about. He wrote on page 80, since defective relations with other human beings have almost always been the immediate cause of our woes, including our alcoholism, no field of investigation could yield more satisfying and valuable rewards than this one. Calm, thoughtful reflection upon personal relations can deepen our insight. We can go far beyond those things which were superficially wrong with us to see those flaws which were basic, flaws which sometimes were responsible for the whole pattern of our lives. Thoroughness, we have found, will pay handsomely. And I take that seriously. And I also know that in learning what I want to see in myself, I use that same those same criteria in judging the people that I let really close to me. Because if there's anything that AA has given me permission to do is to say no to things that are harmful. I haven't been in a toxic relationship for decades now, and because I know how to get out of it and say that's inappropriate. But it is a living thing. And my professor and actually advisor when I was back in school, getting an advanced degree, said process is our most important product. And so I look at the 12-step process, basically, as Bill outlined, I mean, just 60 through 88, as the way to live. You know, he said, called some principles for living. And I guess I do have the spiritual, I'm so glad that they told me when I came into AA, don't read that book without a dictionary. I'm fortunate to have my father's 1939 dictionary, and the first definition of spiritual is non-material. So that applies to my attitudes, emotions, ideas, opinions, understandings, yearnings. Well, yeah, and then my behaviors get added to that. And so that's a part of my third step practice every day, is to be relieved from the bondage of those things that just fuck everything up, you know? I don't need those things. And guess what? AA has taught me that I have a choice. Like I had a choice the day after my last drunk to not drink that day and the next day and the next day. So today is day 15,554, one day at a time. And that's all I have to be concerned about. I don't have to dwell on the past. I don't have to live in the past. I don't have to be projecting into the future all the time. I need to be here now. And that's, of course, the name of the book. But thank you so much for your sharing, for your book, what you're doing for all of us.
Hi. You're very welcome. Thank you for doing this. Really appreciate it. Jeff, your book has really changed my life, actually. I know, and I say you probably hear that quite a bit, and but it's just true. And I related a lot to with the things that you say, and I think I have a lot in common with the way that you are viewing recovery. I've been working with others using your book weekly. We were reading it together to study codependency and applying your principles to codependency. And somewhat it's a unfortunate naming for people with codependency, and there really aren't a lot of secular, you know, a lot of mentions in this meeting about secular AA. As far as I can tell, there's no such thing as secular coda. So I read your book, and I read it as an epiphany. It was really enlightening to me. I'd been really struggling for years to try to get through coda with God and higher power and just people telling me to worship doorknobs. And I could not deal with it. I couldn't take it anymore. And so when I read your, I started looking for secular coda, couldn't find any. I said, okay, well, these AA people, they're doing something. And so I found it. And then I read your book, and it was just like a lightning bolt in my mind. That was a chain reaction of lightning bolts that now has gotten me to do all sorts of stuff. So now last week I had a dozen people showing up to talk about codependency and relating to your book and how we can apply it. And so One of the things that I have found in trying to work this program with other people that I would have a couple questions about, that your just perspective on it, because I have you here. One is that with your program, it's now incumbent upon the individual to take responsibility for doing some things that aren't necessary in traditional program. So as incumbent on the individual, when there's no higher power, or no God to give away control to, you have to assert what that is and do it actively. It's a different process. And I would love to hear what you think about the nature of control and giving up control as an atheist. And then the second thing is, you know, by writing your book, it's an implicit critique of AA and traditional AA and even CODA, and just by its existence, it's a critique, you know, that it says that like what exists is not fully sufficient. And I have found that to be true. And when I first started making rumblings of codependency and codependency of atheism in codependency groups and questioning the need for higher power and whether or not it's necessary as a precondition for recovery. And I got a lot of tradition quoting at me and all kinds of pushback that I really just didn't even care to fight. I don't even care. But a lot of things have come up. I said this, you know, this is maybe life or death. So it's really more than just something to just be flippant about. It's really actually urgently important because there are people being left out of traditional AA, CODA, whatever grouping, because they tell you have to have a higher power. And someone says, well, that's not for me. And so then they walk off and they don't get help. And so to me, your book, work that I'm doing, work that other people are doing to make foundations for secular recovery is really, really important in life or death. So I would love to know your opinions about how should we approach revisions to AA, CODA, each of their books, looking forward, what is your perspective? I don't necessarily see any need to be so hell-bent on preserving tradition when we need to, and just evidence the way the world is, like inclusion needs to happen. So how do we make these groups more inclusive to help more people? And just thank you so much for what you've been doing.
Thanks so much, Matt. Good questions. There's a lot. So I'll try to answer them all. And please, if I miss anything, please let me know. So one of the things that I want to address is, you know, talking about this book as a critique of AA, just by virtue of existing. And I agree with that to an extent. What I try to make very clear, though, in the book is that this is my approach that worked. This is an approach that worked for me. And it can be, this is just a path available. I'm not looking to capture people who are coming into AA and say, hey, this is the wrong way to do it. Go over here. I'm looking to catch the people that are leaving AA because they don't like that approach and are turned off by the talk of God and higher power, and go, hey, don't give up. Here's what worked for me. I still found a way that worked for me to do this without all of that. Give it a try if you want. So that's really, I really try and emphasize that is the attitude with which I wrote this book. So having said that, also, I don't think changing AA or changing any of the 12-step programs is a realistic or achievable goal, at least not in the way that I'm hearing you describe it, where like, can we actually make changes to the fundamental program to be more accepting of people? I think if anything, it's about sort of creating this offshoot that is more friendly to secular approaches, or just this secular version of it. And hopefully over time, that becomes more and more popular and more the norm. I feel like there will always be sort of the traditional, you know, very God-based approach to AA. And I think some people will possibly always need that. And I don't think it's my place to say we need to get rid of it. But I think there just needs to be a path for people for whom that approach doesn't work. And so if anything, I would think, you know, rather than changing AA, let's maybe make it more inclusive, or make another, you know, secular AA, and just attraction rather than promotion when it comes to that as well. You know, just make it a place that's accepting and practical and down to earth and effective and supportive, and hopefully it will grow. There was one other thing you said. You're talking about,
I think that's all spot on. That's exactly, you know, I've been going down this road, and I was really like struggling, fighting from the inside. And I was just like, you guys, like, can't you like share with me? And, yeah, you know, and then I finally was like, because of your book, I realized I had choice and freedom, and I could start my own thing. And at first it was really hard. But now I'm starting to acquire people. Like, just like you said, it's happening. And I'm just so grateful for that.
Thank you. And one of the other things that you mentioned that I do want to just briefly touch on was, you're talking about how, you know, this now falls, the onus then falls on the individual now, as opposed to a higher power. And the thing is, I think that was kind of always the case to some extent. I mean, in traditional AA, they're not generally saying, you know, just, you know, go along for the ride. God's in total control now, and you don't have to do anything. I just think with my approach, I focus on our need to take action and let go of the rest, rather than giving it to something. So the things that those are still things we need to let go. There are still things we need to let go of, right? So to say, like, I'm not saying that we can control everything and we have to do it all ourselves. I'm saying that, you know, there are actions we need to take, but there's still things we need to rely on outside of ourselves. But instead of God or something supernatural, it's, you know, people, relationships, values, principles, you know, and when we're turning something over, rather than this idea that I'm turning it over to some entity that's going to do something with it, I'm just letting it go. And then by me not holding on to it, it will automatically go to whatever is out there. If there's anything, just, you know, cause and effect. But it's not mine anymore. It's not something I'm trying to micromanage and control. So I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it's perfect. And I think we need to develop this language, this new way. You know, we have to talk about it and develop a new framework, because people are like, well, you take away the higher power, what do I have? So thank you.